You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Miriam Spitzer. Miriam or Rabbi Spitzer, how would you like for me to address you in this show?
Rabbi Spitzer's fine.
Good. So Rabbi Spitzer, the question the show begins with is a big one. Who are you? What do we need to know about you to get this conversation started?
You started the show playing a song called Erev Shel Shoshanim, meaning the evening of roses or the evening of flowers. And I chose this song to open the show because this is the song that I had chosen many years ago to walk down the aisle to the chuppah, to the marriage canopy. And this is a song that gives me feelings of romance and anticipation and good things to come. And I wanted to set the tone for this discussion with that music for myself.
And we're going to be playing that in just a minute, because we actually start the show with the introduction of you and this little clip, but this is perfect.
So this song, to me, sounds like it should have come from Shir HaShirim, from the Song of Songs, straight out of the Bible. It gives a feeling like that. The words sound like that, which is another reason that I like it. And we have a Jewish expression for something that's been around a long time that you think of as authentic, that's been around for a long time. We say this is one of those songs that came down from Sinai with Moses, so to speak. Except that this song is not that at all. It's neither from the Song of Songs, nor did it come from Sinai with Moses. It is actually a fairly modern song written in the 1950s by an Israeli poet named Moshe Dor, who happens to be the stepfather of one of the congregants at Temple Beth El here in Ithaca. Which I think is pretty cool. When I met that family and they started talking about that, and I said, "Oh, I know that song. I walked down the pulpit to that song." So you asked what to get to know me a little bit. So one thing to get to know me a little bit as a rabbi is, one of the things that I really like about being a rabbi is that every day is different. You never know what's coming, and you never know when you're going to meet the child or widow of a famous Israeli poet. Who is going to walk through your door and what's going to happen next. And I thrive on that sense of wonder and that sense of not knowing what's coming next and the excitement of being with people.
Right.
So that's something that you can know about me at the beginning.
Very good. Very good. Well, we will play that Erev Shel Shoshanim. Did I pronounce it anywhere near correct?
Erev Shel Shoshanim. Erev being evening. You might have heard that word in other contexts.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Roshech maledi ali, bichel obo
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Play Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Miriam Spitzer.
So, Rabbi Spitzer, Eric, I changed my mind. You can call me Miriam.
So, Miriam, you also came to Ithaca with we can talk about this later, but I want to just kind of highlight this early on. You came to Ithaca as an interim rabbi in a congregation in transition where a rabbi had left after 43 years of service. And you're to help them hire the next rabbi, prepare for the next rabbinate. I want to get to that. So that's kind of a heads up. And you're also headed out of town. So this, in a way, is kind of a swan song. So what are some of the experiences you had to have in life to know the life you value living now and how you might have to approach it to live it?
Are you asking that for me as the interim rabbi at Temple Bethel,
I'm asking that for you as a person and as a rabbi, because these roles flow a little bit in and out of each other, but you can separate them out as much as you want to or need to.
Well, life plays tricks on you. And when you're young, you think that you see a straight line, a straight road, and maybe there's some bends, but you think you know where they're going. And it isn't usually like that, no matter how well you plan it. And usually things happen that's different than what you expected. And that's the wonder of life. And being able to handle that and being able to go forward on that and being able to embrace that is what it's all about in life. So I have experienced my rabbinate in many different forms. And when I first became a rabbi, I said one of the good things about being a rabbi is that I will be able to do many different things without going back to school, without having a career change. And that actually turned out to be true, although it surprised me anyway, because when I first started being a pulpit rabbi, and I wasn't entirely sure I wanted to be a pulpit rabbi when I first started. I had two babies, and I wasn't sure that was the right direction for me at that point. And I found very quickly that not only was it the right direction, but it was my calling. That was what I was called to do. And I use that term deliberately because it's not a Jewish term. And it's not something that rabbis often say, or it's more of a Christian term, but it's definitely I want to retract. It's not a Christian term. It's a term that Christians use more often.
Right. And it's in the call of Samuel or any of the
right, stories. Right. And but it's not something that Jews say all that often, but it's something that I very much feel that being in the pulpit rabbinate is my calling and is what I was meant to do. Nonetheless, I took a hiatus for a long time because, again, life takes different turns and different choices that influence different things. And so I experienced my rabbinate in many different forms, and I'm delighted that now I'm at a point in my life when I can be back in the pulpit. And coming to Ithaca to restart, not to be a beginner, but not to have been a pulpit rabbi for as many years as I've been a rabbi. It was a very good way to do it. It was good. It was good for the congregation, and it was good for me. I came in after I had the distinct privilege of following a wonderful rabbi who stayed with the congregation for a very long time. 43 years is, in the life of a congregation, forever. And so he was with the congregation forever, and I had the distinct honor of following him. And my role was to demonstrate, quite literally, that rabbis come in different shapes, sizes, and priorities and approaches and thought processes
and agendas
and agendas. And I feel very good about it. I feel like I built on what he did, and and did what I came to do with the congregation, and left the community in very good shape for the new rabbi who has just moved in and is starting just now also. And I feel good about that. And I really feel good about the relationships that I made and the people that I met and what I was able to teach and what I was able to share and to bring. And I'm going away with a good deal. I'm really appreciative of all the relationships and the new friends that I'm taking with me as I go. Now I've forgotten the question you've asked, so I don't know if I answered it or not.
Yes. But this is how the show goes. I want to go back and highlight two or three different things. One is you are the first interim rabbi, priest, pastor, any religious interim in town who made an effort to really reach out widely to the other clergy and other religious communities. That is. I've been in this community for over 40 years in one fashion or another, and you're the first person to do that. So that was neat. I also just want to point out that, you know, we use words, different traditions emphasize different words, calling, you know, nobody owns it. And actually it's being taken over by the school where my partner works, Dyson, which is an undergraduate business program at Cornell, to talk about students' sense of vocations in business is what their calling is. And the third thing was, you began even before we played the first piece of music about the excitement of not knowing what you're going to meet each day, and then being kind of thrust into a career change where you're looking at being a pulpit rabbi, which is probably a term most people who listen to the show have not heard before, because it makes sense. You know what it means, but it's not a term that we use. We don't talk about a pulpit preacher or a pulpit minister or whatever. And I'm an ordained minister, but I don't practice in the congregation. But what you described was taking on this interim role, and there is nothing more put your foot to the pedal to the metal, as it were, and just watch all the changes that you can kind of push through in terms of people's awareness, in terms of your meeting people's fears and their hopes and stuff. To be an interim is to just walk into a community that is in transition, and they don't know exactly where they're going to go, and they don't necessarily trust them. And you're the presence to be there with them in that process. And that just seemed like very fitting from your description. How did you learn to become comfortable with that kind of unknown? How did you learn, or have you always faced life this way, or did you have to, What about your upbringing or your personality or has made it so that you have an openness to want to deal with this kind of diversity every day?
Well, there's some things you can't teach in school, and that might be one of them. On the other hand, life is like that. I hadn't really thought about that question quite like that, and I'm not sure if I'm going to like this answer when I do think of it, but it's a lot like being a parent. When you're a parent, you don't know as a mother, you don't know what's coming next.
Right.
And what the kid is going to say, or who the kid's going to say it to, or what ideas are going to come through. And that's actually, I hadn't connected this, but that's actually something that I really love about being a parent also. I have learned so much from my children. And my children now it's not surprising. My children are now adults, but I remember being surprised that when they were little, where did they get that? That didn't come from me. Where did that come from? They learned things. They had ideas, and they had facts, and they had information, and they had things that, like, where did they learn that? And they brought home, and I learned all kinds of things from when they were very little until now, when they are always bringing new thoughts and new ideas and new recipes and new music to share, and poetry, so maybe it comes a little bit from being a mother.
Well, can I just reflect on what you just said, since this seems to be a new question or a new way? You meet them as persons. And you have a role as a parent with them, but you see the wholeness of their person and you're willing to take from them what they bring to you. And my guess is you do a similar sort of thing with people in your congregations. You meet them as the whole people that they either are or hope to be.
Actually, I say that in so many words with the congregation. Part of my philosophy of being a rabbi is to meet each person where they are, to accept each person where they are, wherever they're at in their life journey and their travels, in their Jewish journey and their Jewish travels, to meet them where they are and accept them for what they are and appreciate them for what they bring, and then to help push something them to be one step further. One step more, one step on.
When they can teach you, as your children taught you, you can present things to them that they wouldn't necessarily have wanted or anticipated and have standing.
Well, I believe very strongly that everybody brings something to the community, and sometimes we have to look for it. Sometimes we have to figure out what it is that they're bringing. But everybody has something. That's their comfort level. That's what they're good at. But synagogue, temple life is also about being able to explore what you're not as good at and what you're not as comfortable with, and going beyond your comfort level and into other areas, whether it's Jewish thought that you haven't thought of before, or prayer experiences that you haven't had before, or communal experiences that you haven't had before. And part of my role as rabbi is to help take that next step.
Right. What in sociological terms is you are about the formation of persons and their growth and development over time. And that's different than individuals. Individuals fit a place in society, a place in a family structure. Individuals may have roles in the congregation, but the real purpose of the congregation is to form persons.
Yes.
And to transform them through life cycle events.
I like that.
And in modernity, we've lost sight of that because we are part of a marketplace. We're professionals. We have skills that we sell. We think in terms of contracts, but persons think in terms of covenants.
In terms of what?
In terms of covenants.
Covenants. Now that's a Jewish word.
And we, in a covenant relationship, we do for the other what they cannot do for themselves, but need to thrive. We ask others to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves, but need to thrive. There is no contract. It is a fulfilling of what we need to thrive.
Right. So another thing that I like to be about being a rabbi is that I get to see people in what I call their nexus moments. That is the very highs and the very lows of life. And I get to make a difference to people in those times. But of course, most of the time, it's not the nexus moments. Sometimes it's the nexus moments, but most of the time, it's the regular moments. Mm-hmm. And I really love that too. And you're talking about covenant, and I think about connections. And yes. My role as rabbi is to forge connections. So starting with my connections with myself to the community, that's one role. Connections, helping people forge connections between different people within the Jewish community and each other. Within the Jewish community, connections between the Jewish community, the Jews, and the Torah and the Jewish tradition. That's the teaching aspects. Mm-hmm. That's the being able to give sermons and classes and teaching and making Torah something real and live. And that, I love that. And that's part of what I do. Connections between the Jewish community and the larger community. And that's something that you touched on. I think it's interesting that I'm the only interim rabbi that stepped outside of the community into the larger community, the way into the clergy group. I think that's interesting.
You're not the only interim rabbi. You're the only interim clergy leader from any tradition.
I think that's really interesting. And it's really important to me. I do it because I think it's important for the Jewish community to maintain those contacts. That's part of it. And I do it because it's really important as my role as rabbi. And I actually also, I really enjoy being with the colleagues who are not Jewish. And I often learn a great deal. I can tell all kinds of stories. I often learn a great deal from that. And finally, I don't want to forget. I don't want to not mention when I'm working on connections with the community, connections between the community and God, is also part of my vision.
Miriam, what should we play next musically?
What should we play next? You should play next Aniva Ta Nishaneh Ta Olam, which is a song by Arik Einstein. And I sent you a link to a good place to find it. And what the title means is Aniva Ta, I and you, or you and I in English, we would say, we are going to change the world. What does that mean? We're going to make a difference. And I really like this song because it says, we are together, you and I, you're going to do it, I'm going to do it, we're going to do it. We are going to do things that are going to change the world. And then the next line is, they've said that before. Other people have said that. It's saying, forget it. Other people have said it. And the poet says, I don't care if other people have said it. It doesn't matter that other people have said it. We're still going to go out and change the world step by step. And to me, that plays into the larger Jewish conception of tikkun olam, of repairing the world, of leaving the world better than when we found it. And this is a song that reflects on how I and you and we are going to change the world.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Play Report, and our guest on this episode is Rabbi Miriam Spitzer. So Rabbi Spitzer, I'm going to play with that question slightly, or that observation in a slightly different way. How has this walk to change the world changed you? What has worked? What have you learned that's pressed you to value something different than you thought you valued, or approach life in a way you never thought you would?
I remember when we used to say things like, should we accept gays and lesbians into our community? And what is that question? It was meant to be a welcoming question at the time.
Right.
But it's a mistake. But it took time to get there. And the mistake is that there's us and then there's them. And should we invite them into our community? And I have learned over the years, partially from my communities and partially from my children, and partially from other people, but I have learned that's the wrong approach, even when we're trying to use it as a welcoming approach. And a better approach, maybe not a final approach either, but a better approach is, we are a community made up of many different kinds of people. So we're talking about a Jewish community. We are a Jewish people and a Jewish community, and some of us are men and some of us are women and some of us are other than that. And some of us are gay and some of us are straight and some of us are in between and other than that. But we are all the Jewish community. And some of us are lighter skinned and some of us are darker skinned and some of us speak English and some of us speak Russian and some of us speak Spanish and some of us speak other languages. But we are a Jewish community that are made up of all different colors and all different rainbows. And I think that's a change that took time to get there, but it's now, and it also comes into other things. It comes into how we, and I mean that we as all of us, how we deal with the disabilities that some of us bring, the different kinds of disabilities. So I had a really interesting experience this year in my commitment to meet people where they are and to make sure that everybody is able to function. We decided, if you've been into Temple Beth El, you know that there's a few stairs up to the bima, up to the front, and we honor people by having them come up to the Torah, which requires walking up the stairs. So we decided to attempt to move it. We put a Torah reading table on the floor so that people wouldn't have to climb up the stairs. That's to meet the needs of people who, for whatever reason, can't climb up the stairs. People in a wheelchair, people who can't take the steps for whatever reason. The intention was to be inclusive. And the result was that even though I moved the microphone from the bima onto the floor, that the microphone didn't reach to the table. And so in our desire to meet one need, we found that people who couldn't hear and the microphone couldn't reach, especially people with hearing aids, were entirely left out. So here we're trying so hard to be inclusive and we left an entire population out. So we moved back on the bima with the intention of, if anybody came in who really couldn't take the steps, we would bring the Torah down temporarily for that, until we could get the microphones rewired so that they could be on the floor. And frankly, we never finished that project because that happened right before. This is an effect of being an interim and only having so much time. We got up to this point and then we disbanded services, live services in the room. And so we never finished getting the microphone rewired and going to having it on the floor. But trying to expand the we found that it's not always that simple. It's not always a straight line. That we have to pay attention to lots of different needs and different concerns. But all of that is we, and we have to make it work. And sometimes it takes time and sometimes it takes missteps.
Right, and it's also, It's not just that there are missteps. It's that every step we take is going to miss something. It's like the it's analogous to the idea that every new bit of knowledge I know raises more questions, and my understanding that I know less and less, even with that little bit more that I grab. And what I'm curious about is when in your life, or how did this paradox of, you know, we can't be saying we welcome them to the people who aren't standardly male or female or heterosexual. We need to say we are many. How did that awareness develop in you over time so that you can articulate it so clearly? What were the kinds of insight moments that helped you change?
You know, if you asked me intellectually, I would say that empathy ought to come even on things you don't have personal experience with. Mm-hmm. That the whole purpose of empathy ought to be that you can not necessarily understand what somebody is feeling, but at least understand that they're feeling. What?
That they're feeling something, even if you can't
identify. Right, that you don't have to feel the same thing in order to relate that something's there. But in real life, it's really when you have your own experiences that bring up that empathy, which in some ways my intellect is bothered by this, but it has to do with meeting people. It has to do with children of mine that were queer. It had to do with friends that were and are queer. It had to do with an expanding community. I was the school rabbi for 10 years of a Jewish day school that one of the things that this particular Jewish day school excelled at and worked on was making the school accessible to Jewish children with disabilities. And it's possible that I took the job there because I cared so much about that because I wanted that. Or it's possible that I was already working there and I helped shape the school in that direction. Or it's possible that they hired me because I was the kind of person who would do that. But it all worked together, my experiences with that. I learned that the things that we do in a classroom to help children with specific disabilities end up helping all the children. And that carries into a congregation and that carries into real life. And so it's a learning process. But two of my four children are queer, and one of them has certain disabilities. And yes, that shaped my life in all kinds of ways.
What should we do? What should we play next musically? What should we go to next?
Well, back on the same theme of changing the world, play a song called Bread and Roses. And this particular rendition of Bread and Roses, I forgot to write down the name of the group that brought it together, but I chose this particular rendition because it's I think it's called Women of the World. It's a Women of the World group that the four women of all different colors singing together and singing the song and giving feminist and universal tones and the cross-cultural women singing it. I don't know if your show gives YouTube links in any way, but if people could watch this, they might really enjoy it. But I want to say something about the words of this song. I learned these words first, or part of the words. The song is called Bread and Roses, and I learned the words first when I learned about Rose Schneiderman, who was a union organizer in the early 1900s. And she used this term, bread and roses, in a major speech around 1912, when she was advocating for workers' rights, specifically women's rights, and not limited to, but not excluding, Jewish women's rights. Rose Schneiderman was tiny, reportedly shorter than I am, which is saying something. And she was a firebrand. She's speaking before microphones and before of and apparently she was loud and could be heard. She was a firebrand, and she demanded bread and roses for her people. And what does bread and roses mean? Bread means food and other physical necessities, and roses means flowers or spiritual things, that it's not enough to just feed the workers. The workers also have to have access to the finer things in life, whether that means free public libraries, or whether that means a chance to hear music, or whether that means chance time to walk in the garden and to see the flowers. And so she advocated for both. And there's a lot of Jewish resonances for that because of who she was. She didn't make up this term. This term was made, she maybe made it famous, or was right. One of the people that made it famous, but she didn't make it up. The term was invented in a speech before her, and there was a poem written, and this song is based on the poem.
Thank you. Here we go.
We go marching in the beauty of the day. A million darkened kitchens, a thousand mulots gray, all touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people here are singing bread and roses, bread and roses. As we come marching, we battle too for men, for they are in the struggle, and together we shall win. From birth until life closes, hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we come marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient strife for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their trudging spirits knew. Yes, bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, we're standing proud and tall. The
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Play Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Miriam Spitzer. Where does this meeting life as it rises up before you, where is this taking you next?
I have accepted a position in Scranton, Pennsylvania, as the rabbi, not as interim rabbi. This is as rabbi, and I hope as long-term rabbi. And so I'm going to go to Scranton, where I'm very much looking forward to meeting the people and to making relationships with the people and to bringing who I am to them. In some ways, this is opposite of what I did this year. How so? Because here, as I mentioned, I followed a very active rabbi who had been here for 43 years, and the congregation that I'm taking has been without a rabbi for a whole year. So the work that I'm going to be doing with the community is, I'm thinking about it in a lot of ways is the exact opposite. As opposed to working with people on how can lay people do more and how can lay people adjust and grieve for the loss of a rabbi. Now I'm going to be working on how do lay people let the rabbi in and how and from my end, what's reasonable for me to think is reasonable for me to do and what is something that I should leave alone and let the lay people do and not touch. And that's going to have challenges. Plus, they have a cantor, which I'm very excited about. I'm very excited to work with a cantor, and that's going to have some challenges. Some. How are we going to work together, and how are we going to work it out? I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm well aware that this is going to be different.
Right, right, and it's. I mean, this is where you get to look at creating the space for collaboration, which was the word you used earlier, and how you work together. And I'm just thinking in part, the major figures in a Jewish congregation are the rabbi, the cantor, the temple administrator, if there is one, and the president of the congregation. And that creates kind of a context in which you work. But I'm assuming this is a smaller congregation. And so, but also, Temple Beth El here in Ithaca is this kind of on the edge of the small congregation. Yeah.
The congregation that I'm going into is a small congregation in a large building. That once upon a time, it was a much larger congregation. So that also has some challenges with it. Sure. But they have a stunning building. And this is the year of centennial. They're almost 100 years old, 100 minus one this year. And so we'll be celebrating that. So there's a lot of things to be excited about. I also understand that it's a community that has been there for a while, that the most active members have been members since they were children even. Mm-hmm. So they have a lot invested and that's exciting.
Right. And one of the tasks, I mean, having done some work in congregational consultations, there's a task in helping people to celebrate the memories that are in the container of the building, but not worship the building.
And actually a centennial will be a very good time to do that. Yeah. But not worship the building that's another challenge of this time period.
Yes.
We're not even in the building.
Oh.
Right now, because of COVID. That's hard for any congregation and very hard for this congregation and something that I have to work on and something that everybody's working on with the coming of the high holidays in September. Every community is working on how are we going to do that and what are we going to do? And this is no exception.
Yes. And Passover will have seemed like a breeze compared to what the high holidays could bring on. Anyway, so okay, so let's cut to music again.
And actually this is perfect. The next song it's called Miriam's Song, although sometimes I call it And the Women Dancing with Their Timbrels. Timbrels, yes. Mean tambourines. This is the closest I got when I was looking for music and I wanted something liturgical. I wanted I couldn't find liturgy that I thought was appropriate, but this was close. This is a song by Debbie Friedman, written, now I know, in 1988. and
very famous in conservative and reformed circles.
Yes, it's a wonderful song. And what I really love about this song, this is a song about Miriam, that is Miriam at the Exodus from Egypt. Miriam as in Moses and Aaron's sister, Miriam leading the women in dancing. And this the quote is straight out of the Torah, straight out of the book of Exodus. Miriam led the women in song, and Debbie Friedman imagined that and wrote a song about it. But the question that I like to ask, and that many people have asked, is where did these tambourines that Miriam and the women were holding come from? If you were asked to leave your house and, you know, so fast that you don't even have time to bake bread, and that the bread has to bake as you're walking, that's the matzah of Passover, where did the tambourine, would you bring tambourines with you? And the answer is yes. Miriam and her women had the vision to that, back to bread and roses. Miriam and the women had the vision that the people in the desert were not only gonna need the bread, the matzah, they were also gonna need the roses, the music, and they brought their timbrels, and they were anticipating a miracle. And I learned from this, the importance of the vision and the joy, and bringing the joy and anticipating the miracle, and not anticipating the miracle as in I don't have to do anything because God will provide, kind of anticipating the miracle, but anticipating the wonder of the miracle, anticipating the gratitude, being ready to be grateful, and to have the music ready to be grateful. And so in some ways this is a prayer of thank you. And I really very much enjoy this song. So that's the one you can play next, and then I'll tell you the one that I didn't choose in its place.
She wove was one which sang our history. With every strand and every thread she crafted her delight. A woman touched with spirit, she dances toward the light. And the women dancing with their timbrels followed Miriam as she sang her song. Sing a song to the one whom we've exalted. Miriam and the women danced and danced all night long. When Miriam stood upon the shores and gazed across the sea, the wonder of this miracle she soon came to believe. Whoever thought the sea would part with an outstretched hand, and we would pass to freedom and march to the promised land. And the women dancing with their timbrels followed Miriam as she sang her song. Sing a song to the one who we've exalted. Miriam and the women danced and danced all night long. And Miriam the prophet took her timbrel in her hand, and all the women followed her just as she had planned. And Miriam raised her voice in song, she sang with praise and might. We just lived through a miracle, we're going to dance tonight. And the women dancing with their timbrels followed Miriam as she sang her song. Sing a song to the one who we've exalted. Miriam and the women danced and danced all night long. And the women dancing with their timbrels followed Miriam as she sang her song. Sing a song to the one who we've exalted. Miriam and the women danced and danced all night long.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Miriam Spitzer. So Rabbi Spitzer, you wanted to say a little bit about the song you didn't pick.
Yeah, it's not a liturgical song. I said I was looking for liturgy, and I was. But another song that I looked at that's not remotely liturgical is a Saturday Night Live clip that perhaps you've heard called "This Is Not a Feminist Song," and And I decided not to bring it, but it's something that people can look up if they want. And it, what I liked about that one, and what I like about it in terms of life, is it's humorous. This is not a feminist song. It's funny, but it's also very touching. And why is it not a feminist song? It's about how difficult the enterprise of feminism can be. And it says, this is what we needed, but it was too hard, so we went home, went to bed. And the admission that we don't always complete what we start, that sometimes the job is too hard for us, and we do have to take a break and stop. This is not a feminist song. I like that. I like the giving ourselves a break to go home and you know, we went to bed. We needed to sleep. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate the humor, because I think we need to laugh through life also. I appreciate that song, how it talks about, it also talks about women at different women, different times of life, older women, younger women, political women. And so I got a kick out of that. And it concludes that actually with all that, it really is a feminist song. And I feel like I brought a lot of that in bringing Miriam's song and in bringing Bread and Roses, that I brought a lot of that spirit in these other songs. But I also enjoyed revisiting that one when I was choosing music and thinking about it in different ways.
And as much as you're committed to action, to be a person, you have to be rested and graceful and compassionate. And that sometimes means stepping back. And so we don't often think about that in terms of people who are activists or who really want to take the steps to make a change happen.
Sometimes you make a change happen by sitting back and letting a change happen. And sometimes that's the hardest kind.
I agree with you. So Miriam, what the show ends with a brief reflection on what is it that you do to take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, and how do you know you need to do it?
I'm glad you asked that, because I have three things that I've been doing. There's a joke that's been going around the internet that I've seen now in two or three different times in different forms, that it goes something like this, that the mezuzah on the front door of the house isn't getting the kind of traffic that it usually gets. So what does the person do to fix that problem? Moves the mezuzah from the door of the house to the door of the refrigerator. So one thing that I have done over the course of the past few months is that I've adjusted my eating, and I'm not overeating. I have adjusted my eating so that I'm found that when I stop eating after dinner and don't eat again till lunch, so that means essentially skipping the evening snacks that I was accustomed to having several of, and the and skipping breakfast, which I thought I couldn't make it through the day without, I have found that I'm eating less and I'm less hungry. Totally surprising to me. But if I don't have that bedtime snack, I apparently am not waking up craving breakfast. If I'm not eating, eating something right before bed. So I've adjusted that, and that's a healthier place. So I'm pleased with that. The second thing that I've been doing is I reinstalled on my phone a step counting app, which for no logical reason makes me walk more. So I'm determined to walk my quota of steps is 3 miles a day, and most days I'm making it. And I know there's people who bike 60 miles a day and can laugh at me, but for me, 3 miles a day is significant. And I'm also doing it outside. I'm not big on treadmills. And so I'm outside. So I'm listening to the birds, and I carry a pair of binoculars, and I'm watching the birds and the chipmunks and the beavers at Sapsucker woods, and so I'm enjoying that. And the third thing that I'm doing is that I'm praying daily. And so so I was doing the TBE Zoom Minion. Actually, I was doing it twice a day. I was doing it morning and afternoon. And I will be doing my new temple Zoom Minion very soon, starting next week. But I had a week or 10 days in between, and I've been jumping around. I've been visiting Zoom Minyanim all over the country just to see what I can learn from different people's Zoom Minyanim. But in terms of what it does for me, it's a daily morning grounding, reaching to God, reaching out to the community, even through Zoom. So those are the things that I've been doing and that have been making a huge difference to me. So I'm really glad that you asked that.
And one of the things that you didn't talk about in this particular segment were all the relationships that feed you and also frustrate you, I imagine. All the relationships that feed you and frustrate you. As a clergy person, you know, the emotional care happens through a lot of relationships, unless things are going really badly with either family or congregation or both. Yeah, that's just kind of almost a given in this world.
Well, that actually brings me to the song that I asked you to play at the end, sure. Which is The Weaver's Kiss is Sweeter Than Wine. And I opened with the song that I used to walk down the chuppah, and I talked about anticipation. And this song, Kiss is Sweeter Than Wine, is about the other end of life and about appreciating relationship at the other end of life. And while I don't feel that I'm old and ready to go, like the way the weavers write that, I'm anticipating whole chapters of my life that I've not gotten to yet, God willing.
Which is the last half of the book.
I still think about life as a journey with, how do they say it, with lots of kids and trouble and pain. But, oh, Lord, I do it again. And this is perfect, I think, to where we are as a country and to where I am as a rabbi and a person at a time of both great challenge and great opportunity. And both moving forward, tremendous challenge. Challenge of new things, challenge of COVID, challenge of relationships, race relations and other relations in the country, political challenge, and great opportunity to make a difference in the world, all of us, each one of us. And I want to thank those people who are on the journey with me. Most importantly, my husband, Jeffrey, who's my partner, who makes me laugh and who pushes me to be better. And who I mentioned at the very beginning when about walking to the chuppah, who's still walking with me, who's still taking that journey with me, and who's going to Scranton with me, and we know that it's a new chapter that's going to have some challenges for him too. And I want to appreciate my children. And when I say my children, I mean my four, and also the ones that are partnered with my children, who are also my children. So I just want to give a shout out to those relationships in my life. Of course, also my parents and my sisters and my brother and my nibblings and all the others. But I wanted to give those ones particular shout out just now.
Rabbi Miriam Spitzer, it has been wonderful to get to know you. Miriam, you've been quite a blessing in this community, and I wish you well on your work as it goes forward.
Thank you for everything.
Oh, kisses sweeter than wine. As a young man and never been kissed, I got to thinking over what I had missed. I got me a girl, I kissed her, and then, oh Lord, I kissed her again.
Oh, kisses sweeter than wine. Oh, kisses sweeter than wine.
Sweet wife, and we would be so happy all of our life. He begged and he pleaded like a natural man, and then Oh Lord, I gave him my hand.
Oh, kisses sweeter than wine.
I worked mighty hard, and so did my wife, working hand in hand to make a good life. With corn in the field and wheat in the bins, then, oh Lord, I was the father of twins.
About four, they all had sweethearts a knocking on the door. They all got married and they didn't hesitate. I was, oh Lord, the grandmother of eight.
Oh, kisses sweeter than wine. Now we are old and ready to go. We get to thinking what happened a long time ago. We had a lot of kids, trouble and pain, but, oh Lord, we do it again.
Oh, kisses sweeter than wine. Oh, kisses sweeter than wine.